from Portland, Oregon. This is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Rockne Roll. Coming up this episode, one of Judaism's most prominent spiritual traditions is fasting on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. But for those dealing with disordered eating, this act can have significant unintended consequences. To learn more, I spoke with Maddie Harrop, the former Social Justice Springboard Fellow at Greater Portland Hillel. We recorded this conversation earlier this year before her departure for rabbinical school, exploring Maddie's own experience with this particular situation and the resources available for those in such a position this holiday season, as well as what draws her to pursue the rabbinate. Shana Tova, Happy New Year to you all. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, presenting A Night to Remember, a memorial service for the one-year anniversary of the Hamas terror attacks in Israel, Sunday, October 6th, at Congregation Neve Shalom in Portland. Pre-registration is required, free, and available online at jewishportland.org/OCT7Memorial. Now, here's Maddie Harrop. Maddie Harrop, welcome to the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you here. So tell me about your Jewish journey.
So it's something I love to share a lot, and I shared it a lot with my students, actually. I was raised in a Reform Jewish community, but Reform in the sense of when I started maybe in middle school and high school, we went to high holiday services. I started Sunday school in about fourth grade. We did some holiday stuff as a family, but it was a different context of being raised versus what I adhere to now as someone going to rabbinical school in the conservative movement. It's quite a journey. So I grew up with that context of Judaism. So it's not I never had that, but I didn't have that context of prayer and text that I got when I started. So middle school was really that transformative time for me when I went to this day school for 3 years, started learning that text, started getting involved in a more traditional context, even though it was a non-Orthodox, very diverse school. And then high school, I started going to a conservative synagogue. That's when I really felt connected to prayer. Prayer is what really drew me into Judaism from the time I was a very young child, but I couldn't pinpoint that until I got to high school. I sought out a synagogue myself, and I was like, oh, this is my space. This is where I want to be. And that was throughout high school. I would go to services. College, it was off and on. I would be involved in my synagogue at home, but I went to Brandeis for undergrad, so super Jewish. You don't really have to seek out Jewish community there. It's very much
Jewish community finds you.
Jewish community finds me 100%. And then being in university during COVID was a whole other experience. But then that got me even more involved in my home community, where we had daily minyanim, daily prayer services on Zoom. At the time, the conservative movement was kind of like, we need to still be able to congregate. We need to count a minyan on Zoom in order for people to feel that connection, be able to say certain prayers, et cetera. And then I started at Hillel. It became my job, not just a passion and my identity. It was all rolled into one. And so it's been a long time coming. And I think I, for a long time, wanted to go to rabbinical school or some idea of that, but didn't have that. I just thought growing up that rabbis just study Torah all the time. I thought that's I was like, oh, sure. They just read the five books of the Torah. That's it. Don't forget about the Talmud. Forget about contemporary rabbinic commentaries, all that stuff. And so
not to mention all the other things that rabbis do.
Right, all the other things that rabbis do, the logistics, the hard work that it takes, that the social emotional intelligence that you need. So I gained all of that knowledge over time, over those various experiences that I had, among others, and that's what's brought me to this moment.
So by the time this podcast comes out, you will be in rabbinical school.
Yes, by the time this comes out, I will be, I guess, a few weeks, if not a month, into rabbinical school. So I'm going to be at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and I'm starting in the first year. There's something they call a mechina year, which is if you need some more preparatory time. And so I did a lot of work to make sure that I wanted to start out in that first year, running, get started running with all the stuff that we dive into. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting. It's, for me, so being a Springboard Fellow at Greater Portland Hillel was really, that was my dream, being a Springboard Fellow when I was in college. I knew I wanted to be a rabbi very long term. I didn't know when that would happen. And this was my transition point. So now I feel like I'm really ready to start in the rabbinate, even with all that's going on in the world right now. Super heavy. Yeah.
So Yom Kippur is, even people that don't know a lot about Judaism tend to know that Jews fast on Yom Kippur.
Why is that fast considered so important? Because it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really big deal. And it's so funny that growing up in the Reform community, we didn't, the spaces that I was in, right? Mm-hmm. This is my one experience among many other experiences as a Reform Jew. It's not, I wasn't like raised to be like, at this age you start fasting. And this is why we do it. This is mm-hmm. like the text, the evidence, both in the Torah and then the Talmud commentaries. I just knew that it was a practice that in my community, some engaged with, some didn't. It didn't necessarily do it for the full 25 hours. It was more about if you feel connected to it and drawn to it, then absolutely you should. And it was something I really came into knowing from that context. It's funny how in text, like even the origin of it is not saying in the Torah, don't eat and drink food on Yom Kippur, on this Day of Atonement. Mm-hmm. It's talking about self-affliction and self-denial. And then, I mean, the Talmud goes into all kinds of different like linguistic differentiations of like, it could have said this. Why didn't it say that? Or, and then the rabbis have all these arguments.
As the Talmud does.
Right, as the Talmud does, which is stunning. I think it's really fascinating. How I understand it is that it's a very spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. It's where, you know, maybe more nowadays we think in a very about our physical bodies as much as our social emotional selves and our spiritual selves, where fasting historically, how I understand it is like it's just a sacred act, a sacred practice. It's part of that process of tshuva, of repentance, of return, and that process is something that starts before Yom Kippur, but mm-hmm. like it's not for some just a very natural part of Yom Kippur. Like that's the thing that you do, and that's the thing that that every Jew who knows about Yom Kippur, they know that like you don't eat on Yom Kippur. And if you're eating, you know, chas v'shalom, you know, God forbid, you're doing this like, you know, it's against Yom Kippur because that's the one thing that you do that didn't show up to shul if you go to synagogue. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? It's something I've really been unpacking for a long time for many different reasons, which we'll get into.
I was about to say that leads nicely into there are definitely some reasons that someone would want to or even need to eat on what would otherwise be a day of not eating.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's something that I got into, that I looked into more as I was struggling with my own body image and my own personal mental health history mm-hmm. of, I can't say I can pinpoint the exact time when I started fasting, but I know the time when I did my full fast, I was not doing well. And I knew at that point, now I didn't have a medical diagnosis of, let's say there's someone who has to take medication with food. It wasn't something like that, mm-hmm. where that's very literal, where the Talmud can be very literal in the sense of if you have this medical diagnosis or if you have this medication you take, well, the modern interpretation of the Talmud,
of course.
Then you don't fast because you have to do, because that's like pikuach nefesh, like that's saving a life. You're not going to risk your life for the sake of this act on Yom Kippur. Mm-hmm. For me, it was complicated because to get into this part, you know, I'm in recovery from anorexia. I've been in recovery for over 7 years, and it is a physical illness, and it's also it's in the mind. Mm-hmm. It's very in the mind. So I can be completely, you know, physically healthy and doing all those right things, and still have those mental behaviors going through my mind. And so that's where for me it got complicated of, well, I could in theory observe Yom Kippur. I right now, being 7 years in recovery, am at a healthy weight. I'm doing well in that way. I can work through those different behaviors that may come up in my head and not act on them. Does that mean though that it's the best practice for me to observe Yom Kippur? And a lot of people with eating disorder who are in eating disorder recovery have that question for themselves, or have other mental struggles that they're going through. Mm-hmm. Because it's not, my father, for instance, like he takes medication and he needs to take it with food. Again, like that's a very straightforward, you need to do that. Mm-hmm. Or someone who has other specific medical diagnoses. Anyway, it's something that every year when Yom Kippur approaches, I'm always rethinking my own process about it. It's complicated, to say the least.
It sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah.
And I imagine it would be complicated for other people who find themselves in similar circumstances.
Yeah, 100%. And especially where I can only speak for the spaces I've encountered, mm-hmm. that, you know, if someone's eating on Yom Kippur, you don't talk about it. That's not saying that someone should, you know, in front of the congregation where, as someone who's going to be a rabbi, right, let's say there's a Yom Kippur that comes around where I need to eat. I say to myself, it would be risking my recovery to not eat, to mm-hmm. fully fast, therefore I have to do that. Am I going to speak in my sermon to the congregation of, like, I don't know, let's say I'm at a larger congregation of, like, hundreds of people, a lot who probably are fasting in some capacity, would I say, oh, yeah, I'm eating. I just had a great sandwich on Yom Kippur. It's maybe we'll get there as a community where we can say that, and that's, like, not the, you know, people can still engage in their own sacred acts and have that not be each other's practices not be impacting each other. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's complicated.
Needless to say, you're not going to be up on the bima just wolfing down a slice of babka.
Right. Exactly. Like, wouldn't that be no, that's something that because that's the important practice on Yom Kippur is that we're, because for many folks who have not experienced eating disorders, disordered eating, those sort of mental health difficulties, that fasting is simply, it's just that, a sacred act. It's just that, it's just fasting. Mm-hmm. And you know that in 25 hours or, you know, thereabout, depending on the community that you're in, if you're counting exactly or just at sundown, you're going to eat again. And sure, you're missing food, but simply from the point of like, oh, you know, I'm thinking about that. It's whenever someone's really hungry, you know, oh, I think about that pizza that I had that other day. It was so good. Why can't I have it now? You know, I'll have it as soon as the fast is done. Mm-hmm. But then when you have, in my context of an eating disorder, it's saying like, if I don't eat, then that's engaging in a behavior, in my context of an eating disorder.
Yeah.
And so every year it's that line of, am I risking my recovery by engaging in Yom Kippur in any capacity? Even if it's eating, even if it's saying I'm going to eat foods I don't enjoy, or I'm going to, in terms of that self-denial, mm-hmm. or if I'm going to only have a couple meals. Now, the difficult thing also is going to be a rabbi, I will be in services all day if I work in a pulpit. Or if I'm working in some community context, I'm going to be with people for most of the
day. You're going to be busy on the high holidays.
I'm going to be busy on the high holidays. That is for sure. That's why rabbis love cheshvan and other Jewish professionals. Because that's where, except the sigd, which is at the very end of the month, the whole month is no holidays. So it's very like packed for the high holidays. And so there's so many barriers to entry, I feel like, and barriers to having a frank conversation about, I am choosing to eat on a fast day such as Yom Kippur. There's also Tisha B'Av, which is the 9th of Av, and that's another full 25-hour fast. Mm-hmm. There are other fasts from sunrise to sunset throughout the year. And my perspective would be the same no matter what. It's like, am I going to risk my recovery by engaging in this sacred act? Are there other sacred acts that I can do that are forms of self-denial and forms of tshuva that will be more meaningful for me? And I also think about, it's funny, there's this person on TikTok, her name's Miriam Ezagwe, I want to say is how you pronounce her last name. She's an Orthodox woman who talks about what her life is like. That's her intro, like every one of her videos. And I was first introduced to the idea that's found in the Talmud, but I'd heard it from her saying it of like, we live by the laws, not die by them. And that's very, the Hebrew equivalent is found in the Talmud. It was actually found in this section that I studied when I was preparing for rabbinical school from Yoma. It was Yoma 85b, I want to say. And it's a reference from the Torah originally anyway. But the context is, you know, if that's going to harm me by engaging in that fast, then why am I doing it? Mm-hmm. Honestly.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So what kind of resources out there are available for folks who are struggling with this kind of decision? Because as you alluded to, this is not necessarily something that gets, to use a glib turn of phrase, discussed in polite company.
There are some parts of the Jewish community where we are having more open conversations and frank conversations about it. I'm hoping that I can contribute to that, again, just with my one story that is of many. The one main resource that I always think about, and I tried to find others that are similar, but this is really the one that's so niche into this subject, is A Mitzvah to Eat. And that's literally what it's called. They have an Instagram. I feel like they would be on Facebook as well. They have their own website and the resources. And simply just the phrases that they give out, they cite, you know, rabbinic, biblical, contemporary texts of saying, it's okay if you need to eat, if this is something that you need to do in order to observe this sacred day. It's like giving permission mm-hmm. of like, you're allowed to do that, you know, and that it's okay, and that that's going to make the day more meaningful. It's going to keep you on that either path of recovery, in my context, on a path of good health in all those contexts. it's engaging in that conversation very openly. I would say that's the main I don't know if it's a nonprofit, but it's the main organization that does that kind of work. There's the Blue Dove Foundation, which does general mental health resources for the Jewish community. There are some folks who will post articles about eating disorders mm-hmm. on that site, along with many other things. They post about all the different holidays. So they have, you know, body positivity for Tu B'Shvat, for the New Year of the Trees. And that's one of my favorite resources they have. Because that's part of, for me, that's an ongoing conversation, you know, beyond Yom Kippur. Outside of those, like, more online resources, and you can get their resources on paper as well, that I would say, you know, if a person's looking to their local rabbi, or the phrase, I hope I'm correct in saying this, is like Mara Deatra, which is like it's the local rabbinic authority. Mm-hmm. And so for folks in a community where that is their custom, for many other halachic, like legal questions, to say, well, in this instance, what do I do? What do I not do? I would encourage a person to seek them out, because it's really important, even if you're just looking for their general opinion, or you're looking for, like, what does it say in halacha about what we should or shouldn't do, then I would encourage a person to go in that direction. You know, I've spoken to my own rabbinic mentors about these subjects, not necessarily from a point for me of citing text and what am I allowed and not allowed to do, mm-hmm. but more as, like, they're a comforting space and they're a person that I trust. And I hope to be a person that other people trust in that conversation as well. If someone's looking for a legal citation, I can give them that as well once I learn it, you know.
That's the crucial step.
That's the crucial step, for sure. But that part is really important. And not just that, that's sort of the more legal, like halachic mm-hmm. resource. But also if someone has a therapist or a mental health professional, again, in my context of eating disorder recovery, I talk about that with my therapist or support equivalent. Even if they're not Jewish, there's the idea, they can understand the idea of a religious ritual and is that going to interfere with my recovery, engaging in behavior, all those questions. That's for a person where mental health is more like the struggle there. Yeah. And selfishly, I will say I have a Safaria source sheet that talks about eating or not eating as tshuva, or as like, as a process on Yom Kippur. Now, it's still very much a work in progress, but if you look up eating disorder on Safaria, my worksheets are the only ones that really come up. It's not, because people are talking about it, but there's a lot of growth, I think.
I'm glad to hear that growth is happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for someone that's looking for some sort of act of self-denial on Yom Kippur or mm-hmm. another day like that, what are some activities just that you can think of that have worked for you that can replace that act of not eating if that's not going to work mm-hmm. for somebody's circumstances?
Yeah, I think about this as every year rolls around, and I'm still building my own toolkit, to be honest. I think typically folks in the more traditional, quote unquote, you know, observing halacha mm-hmm. in Judaism will not use their phone on Yom Kippur and not use many other electronic devices. That said, for folks where that is not their practice, then it could be a practice of not engaging. So it's like self-denial in our current context of, you know, I'm constantly on my phone, you know, and so like for someone to turn that off and to say that's going to be my thing that I'm doing, or let's say a person enjoys writing and they're not going to do that day. Again, for someone where this is not already their practice, right. Per, you know, halacha or whatever. There's also, I am a real fan of contemplative practices, of meditation, of breath work, of Jewish prayer in particular. So if that's something that resonates with someone, I would highly encourage them to do that. And maybe it's also in a shorter way, you know, doing a short meditation after you have your meal or before you have your meal, if that's how you choose to engage. Either regrounding or grounding yourself in that meal of saying, this is why I'm doing this. This is the best choice for me. Eating right now is a sacred practice, and I'm giving myself permission. There are, I forget, I think it's called Ritual Well. It's created through the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of authors who create these different writings, just creative writings, and some are relating to blessings around eating. It can be blessings around eating if you're in recovery, but it can just be in general. So seeking those out, or doing that breath work of like grounding your nervous system, or just engaging in that spiritual work, because it is such a spiritual day. Yeah. Just because you're not fasting doesn't mean it's not a spiritual and meaningful day for you, and it doesn't mean that you're not on that process of tshuva, of repentance, of return, of seeking yourself and finding yourself, and being with the entire community as they're confronting their past year and their past mistakes or successes and everything in between. That's not a barrier. And to do, for me, it's contemplative practices. That's something I love to do. I ground myself in that. So I can have that meal and then I can go on back, either back to the prayer service or back to whatever I'm doing that day to make Yom Kippur the most meaningful it can be.
Mm-hmm. When you've had conversations with folks around your practice on Yom Kippur, what have those conversations looked like? Have they been positive? I know you mentioned that for some people, eating on Yom Kippur is God forbid.
For some I've talked to, it's just a relative exposure of, like, there are some who grew up in the community where that's just always been their practice. Even if you haven't necessarily thought about why, you know, it's like that Na'aseh v'Nishma, like you'll do and then you will literally, I think it's like listen or learn or something like that. So it's about just that relative exposure of, oh, I didn't even realize that that could be a sacred practice that I could do. But every person who I've spoken to, because I am very open about eating disorder recovery, so I will say that's the reason I don't do it, mm-hmm. or I don't fast for most years, they're like, that makes sense. Or they're like, in today and here and now where we have that concept of mental health knowledge, mm-hmm. it's not a question. You're in recovery from an eating disorder, why would you fast if that was a behavior that you engaged in? But every person's experience is different. There maybe is a person who has that really sacred grounding, who can maintain that recovery and find ways to make that a meaningful practice, whether it's fully fasting, whether it's engaging in, there's a concept of shiurim, I think is what it's called, where you have measurements of food or drink and you consume that. That's often the case for someone who's breastfeeding after they had a child. That's mm-hmm. something that's highly encouraged for someone who, when Yom Kippur comes around.
Yeah.
But then I would imagine in general that that can be a practice for someone who doesn't want to maybe fully have a meal, but do it halfway. And so for many initially, it's like, oh, that makes sense that you're eating, and curiosity. Like they meet me with curiosity of, I want to hear more about it. I want to hear more about what makes Yom Kippur meaningful for you. And then I want to hear what makes it meaningful for them. Because again, for so many, fasting is such a sacred act. Mm-hmm. And that's so beautiful to witness. The fasting is not the sacred practice for me, but there are other things that are. So we can meet in that, those divine sparks that are bringing us together, yeah. if that makes sense.
It does, absolutely.
Yeah.
So as pointed out earlier, you are off to rabbinical school. By the time listeners are hearing this, you will be a rabbinical student.
Yes, yeah.
What is it that drew you to the rabbinate?
It's a really good question.
That's what they pay me for.
Exactly. It's first what drew me to Judaism, I would say, and then what drew me to the rabbinate. What drew me to the rabbinate, at first at least, were all the different rabbis that I'd met in my journey, in my Jewish journey, where I was strengthening it and deepening my connection. Mm-hmm. And seeing that, again, when I was, I want to say, 8 or 9, when I started Sunday school, I truly deeply thought that a rabbi just sat, didn't just sit around, but, you know, a lot of what they did is read from the Torah or study Torah, and that is the practice for many rabbis. I'm mm-hmm. not saying that is a part of the sacred work, and for many, there's so many different pieces to it. So over from, I want to say, high school, when I started going to the conservative synagogue that I went to in Pittsburgh, and seeing the rabbi there and witnessing over time all the work that he did, and slowly, it's slowly almost being revealed to me, you know, as I saw all the different contexts that he was working in, both in Pittsburgh after Tree of Life in 2018, during COVID, when he would be in the sanctuary with 50, 60, 70 people on Zoom for Shabbos, and he'd be in the sanctuary by himself, and all the things that went into that. And in the last year of the depth of pain and suffering that we've witnessed in the world, in Israel, it's all of that has built up to seeing the full spectrum of what a rabbi does. And I don't even have the full context yet because I'm not even in school yet. But seeing that, it just gave me more and more reasons to want to go. Growing up, I loved text. I'm such a book nerd since I was a very young child. And so natural step. Judaism is like, it's in the books. It is the books.
The people of the book.
The people of the book, exactly. And then it became about prayer. It became about that in a vague way of like, oh, these songs are so beautiful. They're so spiritual. What do these things mean? What is God? Who is God? Where is God? Why? How? You know? And as I grew in my Jewish journey, and as I was more exposed to like the work of a rabbi and the life of a rabbi, I was like, all the more so is this where I see myself going in the long term. Because the main reason I applied also, and the main reason, the main thing I want to do is be a resource for people. Mm-hmm. Because I think as much as we have a strong, the voices of mental health work and advocacy are maybe louder, that doesn't mean that there's still that, there's not that support that's needed. And actually all the more so because people are being more vocal about their experiences, those resources are all the more so needed. And the work of a therapist is essential there. You know, a rabbi is not a therapist. So there may be someone who's ordained who also has that training and then works as a therapist. Fine. But that's would not be my context necessarily. But someone who can have that spiritual guide and that spiritual resource who, someone who I work with at Lewis and Clark College, who's not on the Hillel team, but she works with spiritual life. Mm-hmm. She gave me this context when we were texting. I was saying how nervous I was to start school during such a complex time for the Jewish world. And she said, first of all, that she started during a very difficult time in her ministry. And also that it's not about fixing things or about necessarily the action steps that a rabbi takes, but being on that journey with someone and just walking, as we say, like walking humbly with Hashem, like walking humbly with them, with that person or that community. And that alone is such a beautiful and sacred act. I've had people, rabbis and not, and teachers and mentors who have done that for me throughout my life. And if I can even bring a fraction of that to a community, to the communities I'm already in, then that alone is so beautiful. And then the text, and then the logistical work, and what it means to run a congregation or be, you know, working at a Hillel or working at a nonprofit. Rabbis do so many different things.
That's true.
Yeah, and that all is going to come, but like I care about being a resource and being able to support folks and uplift them in those divine sparks within them as much as I try to do within myself. I'm not always good at practicing what I preach, but I really do try.
I think so. That's what counts.
Exactly. That's what counts.
That's really beautifully explained.
Thank you.
There's reports to come out that enrollment is down at rabbinical schools everywhere. Why is rabbinical work so important now? And what would you say to the next generation following after you that's maybe in the situation you were in 5-6 years ago and thinking, maybe I want to be a rabbi? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard question. Because it's something that, like, I will say that so many rabbis, or not so many, several rabbis I know now are very concerned about the future of, not the rabbinate, there's always going to be rabbis, but about mm-hmm. how many folks are applying. Because, you know, eventually they're going to retire and they can do some of that work post-retirement, you know, be a rabbi emeritus, but it's not the same. And I guess I'll sort of answer the question with a question of, or a question for the world of, like, people are questioning religion in so many different capacities right now of, like, what does it mean to be religious? What does it mean to adhere to a faith, to a faith practice and tradition and things like this? And also that, and I thought about this when I was applying to rabbinical school. You can do many different, you can be a therapist, you can get a grad degree in Jewish education, in Talmud, in an academic context, or so many other things, and do a lot of the work that, a lot of the pieces of the work that a rabbi does. And at least something that I've been thinking about recently is that a rabbi has all these different roles and it brings it together. So they can have that role of not a therapist, but of a compassionate listener and mm-hmm. a non-judgmental space. And they're not going to have the answers, but they can listen. They can give you resources. They can say, oh, here's this psalm that either I found comforting or that may bring comfort to you. Or even like if someone's experiencing anger or happiness, psalms is good for like every emotion, honestly. Every emotion under the sun is found in Tehillim. And a rabbi can give that resource. And so there's all these different pieces that can come together. And people come from all walks of life in the rabbinate. People come from doing more of the hard sciences, the social sciences, which is where I came from. People could study Jewish studies all their life and then go to the rabbinate. And that's for them, that's a more obvious natural step. But there's so much that a rabbi can do and that a rabbi does do. And there's such beauty in that role. And so I want to show people that. It's hard for me to say explicit, like in words, but I hope to show it through what I hope to do. Even if I don't want to, you know, I'm not trying to make like this huge, huge impact on the world or anything like that. There are some rabbis that are like, I have all these aspirations and all these things. But even just being that resource and embodying the practices of being that listener, being that guide, being a prayer leader, being a teacher and all these different pieces coming together, I hope that that will inspire people to say, like, this is work that I can do. And also to say it's okay to need support. I think there's also a thing of rabbis can carry a great weight on them of holding a community. That doesn't mean they don't need someone to hold them.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, the therapists have therapists, and their therapists have therapists, like a grand therapist is something I saw on TikTok, you know, and rabbis have their rabbis that they go to, yeah. And then they had their rabbis that they went to. It's this multi-generational almost. And there's such a beauty in that community. And in being a rabbi, how I see it, you're not separate from the community. Sometimes in some synagogues, just by the nature of the synagogue and how it's been, it can be more top down, mm-hmm. where the rabbi and the kahal, the congregation, and some folks in between. I want people to see that it's someone coming from amongst the congregation, amongst the community. That's how I learned it when I did a fellowship to become a prayer leader with the Hadar Institute in New York, where the leader of that, she articulated it as, you're coming from amongst the kahal, the congregation, to go up and lead, where like any person can do that. Any person has that within them, has that capacity. It's if you want to hone that energy, and if that you see that as your calling. I'm hoping that that will continue to be a thing. And even if we're small and mighty, you know, I want people to see the rabbinate as something that can be so beautiful and abundant and important in our world, in addition to all the folks who do those pieces when you break down the role of a rabbi.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have every confidence you will demonstrate that in years to come, and I look forward to seeing you do so. Maddie Harrop, thank you so much for joining us on the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Jewish Review Podcast. Thank you so much to Maddie Harrop for sharing her story and insight. As mentioned, she's now a rabbinic student at JTS in New York and was recently named the Rabbinic Fellow with Hillel at Binghamton University. Mazel tov, Maddie, and best wishes for an exciting future. If you're looking for resources and information this holiday season, check out the Federation's High Holy Days Happenings page online at jewishportland.org/High Holy Days Happenings. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice, subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. Don't forget, you can get the latest news from Portland's Jewish community by subscribing to the Jewish Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. The Jewish Review podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karone Blau Rothstein. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, a happy and sweet new year to you and yours.